the Fukhri neighborhood of Khan Yunis. So, and now many of these people are displaced again and going to a new, I mean, it's even, even just having to change facilities continuously and then trying to clean those facilities and then them getting airstriked. I mean, the Nasser medical complex has been attacked so many times during the course of this genocide. It's unbelievable, but I shouldn't use the word unbelievable because it is very believable. It's a genocide. But it's hard for us who are not in Gaza and who are not residually in Gaza, even international healthcare providers, when they go to Gaza or the West Bank. It's obviously a different experience than those who live there and whose food and whose clothing, whose water, whose tents, this all affects them, right? Like we were talking about this earlier, right? Like people don't even have toilets to go to. And I was talking to people, I mean, many times around some of these tents, they're digging holes in the ground and cleaning themselves over there. And so it's a terrible situation in every respect.
Interesting concept in your paper in The Lancet last week, that in Gaza, you've got vis-a-vis these multiply resistant strains of bacteria, that there is very high sustained selection pressure. So all the conditions are there. This is Charles Darwin. You're selecting for drug-resistant bacteria by, well, what? Like, how can you explain what this concept of sustained selective pressure is?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're the expert, so you can explain it better than I can. But
and I would ask a corollary question that you can tackle after you've to explain what sustained selective pressure is. That these drug-resistant bacteria that are resistant to colistin, which is the drug of last resort, they don't just stay in Gaza. I'm wondering whether Israel, the Israeli medical system, can anticipate being suddenly flooded with brand new multi-drug and pan-resistant bacteria from Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to sustained selection pressure, I mean, I guess the simple way to think about it is that the conditions, as you yourself said, I mean, the conditions exist for it to continue, right? The environmental conditions for these bacteria to continue proliferating, to continue being a problem, are there. And so, and I mean, this is concerning. And the thing is, I mean, something that I've mentioned to other people as well is, even if there's a ceasefire today, this is not going to just reverse. Like you cannot reverse the destruction of bakeries. You cannot just reverse the destruction of the desalination systems. You cannot reverse the destruction of the sewage system. This will take years, if not decades, to rebuild and to get to. I mean, another important point to keep in mind is multi-drug resistant bacteria was already prevalent in Gaza prior to the genocide, because of Israel's blockade. And we note this in the comment. We talk about previous studies that have looked at this. And obviously, they've looked at it from different angles at different hospitals and different time periods. But so it's hard to give you kind of a temporal comparison of that. That was the percentage then, and this is the percentage now.
But some years ago, I was talking with Hassan Abusita, the renowned orthopedic surgeon, following, I think it was the 2019 assault on the Great March of Return. And he was there around that time examining gunshot wounds and grievous injuries to the knees. And he was talking about the prevalence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know Hassan. Yeah. And yeah, we actually did a paper together actually also on combating infections under siege. It was published last year in regards to Gaza.
So is this going to spread to Israel? I mean, is it going to spread globally, or is Gaza kind of like a focus for brand new drug-resistant bacteria all around the world? Because, I mean, we remember the famous drug-resistant bug that was born in somewhere in India and then spread all around the world, because that's what they do.
I mean, in our concluding sentence in the piece in The Lancet, Infectious Disease, we allude to that. We say it will probably disseminate far beyond Gaza's borders, and I think it is totally possible. I mean, it's hard to say how it will spread and where it will get to. And obviously now, another thing is we have to keep in mind, Israel is blockading Gaza. And so to one of the reasons probably why it hasn't maybe spread is because Israel is genociding the population and is blockading so to the extent that it is even difficult, because the human-to-human contact is also limited from people outside of Gaza and inside of Gaza. But obviously there's a risk of it spreading, and We even see with, for example, the reemergence of polio last year. We saw that there was a somewhat constant, I mean, obviously Israel was still killing people, but a somewhat concentrated drive and some laxity in permission to UN agencies to begin programs to vaccinate children with the polio vaccine. But part of it is undeniably from a risk that it could spread to areas outside of Gaza. So obviously that's a part of the calculation of the Israeli military in any of the things that they're conducting. But again, the Israelis have quite a strong healthcare system, and obviously because they are compared to Gaza, I mean, it's a there's really no comparison to make between those two. And so the Israelis' ability to handle any healthcare crisis is far different than anything that the Palestinian population would be able to do, or even in neighboring Sinai and Egypt. So yes, there is that risk, but our concern for Gaza should not come out of the risk of it spreading. It should come on the basis that it's happening to the Palestinian population, which I'm sure you agree with. It's a, regardless of if it spreads or not, the fact that it's happening to these people is a concern in its own right.
Bilal, you write, the international medical community has a duty to act and respond to this crisis. First and foremost, healthcare workers and governments worldwide must advocate for the cessation of the Israeli military invasion. Talk about this if you can. What is the duty of the international medical community, and are they taking up that duty?
They're obviously not taking up that duty, at least insofar as in that we look to professional medical associations that have been woefully silent. And I mean, you can kind of see the comparison to, for example, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The contrast is so massive. But that's not the only contrast that we should be putting it to. I mean, Israel's conduct in Gaza is genocide. And as the recent report, actually, I think there were some UN folks that were involved, right, in that Medicide report that kind of came out of that terminology. I mean, this is a concern for the entire international medical community, and something that we've been talking about in at least some of our circles has been, I mean, journals, medical journals have a duty to be amplifying, especially in the time of genocide, instead of writing about it, which I'm sure many of these journals who have been silent about it will be writing about it a few decades from now about, oh, our failure. And they'll maybe even do a little investigation and write a few papers and invite some survivors to talk about, how did we fail to address the crisis and whatnot? And I mean, that is so incredibly disingenuous. But it also speaks to how so many medical associations and so many journals, again, at the end of the day, in some ways it's important for, I mean, medicine is cannot be removed from the political context. So we should not shy, we like we really should not be shying away from talking about the sociopolitical and sociocultural context that shape medicine and healthcare outcomes and healthcare delivery. But part of that is obviously there's human beings that are involved in editorialship, that are involved in peer review, that are involved in these medical societies that have been silent and that have not been pressuring their governments or publishing the sort of studies that you would need. I know so many Palestinians that are not able to publish their data because of how restrictive. And in many ways, I mean, I've seen, I mean, if I can tell you, the sort of peer review comments that I've gotten across so many journals has been, and or journals where I've been peer reviewing and I've been seeing other peer reviewers' comments all the way from, oh, don't use the term genocide, don't talk about this, don't talk about that, or how do you know that they're civilians? As if non-civilians, quote unquote, are not able to be get medical treatment. I mean, there are just so many sorts of questions and assumptions, and there are many of them are forced to recite condemnations of XYZ groups before they're able to publish their data or are asked to put those sort of things into their papers. So it's unfortunately the medical community has a huge bias against this. And if we're looking at, like, I mean, what's happening in the US and the UK, I mean, people, so many healthcare workers have been dismissed from their jobs for speaking out about Gaza, for going to protests, for writing about
Indeed.
it.
So, in other words, far from actually doing something to end the genocide, the medical community and the authorities who govern American medical schools, they're actually stifling free
Oh yeah,
speech.
they're punishing. They're punishing. It's not even like a not taking a position. They're actively punishing people who are speaking out. So it's unfortunate, but I guess the I would say a glimmer of hope is I have spoken to so many people, even people who do occupy these sorts of roles, and you can see that many of them internally disagree with what they are doing or what they're forced to do in a way. Not that excuses what they're doing, but you do see kind of the amount of political pressure and financial pressure that is being exerted on people. And the medical community is just one smaller example. It's like a microsome of what's happening across American and European society, in trying to, especially in the United States. I think it's far more extreme than what's happening in at least certain countries of Europe, which are a bit better with this regard.
Bilal, what feedback have you gotten, you and your two colleagues, to this comment that you published in The Lancet last week, multi-drug-resistant bacteria amid health system collapse in Gaza? Have you gotten any feedback or blowback?
I mean, I would say we've gotten a ton of positive feedback from Palestinians in Gaza, which is again who this piece is for, and whose voices we seek to amplify. We've gotten really great feedback from other media, other press, other international healthcare providers who've been to Gaza or to the West Bank. So really positive in that sense. And obviously there are critics, and you will get the odd email of previously when I published in The Lancet as well about Gaza. You get the odd emails about either with very subtle death threats or with very subtle other sort of kind of threats layered at you, or just sometimes outright racist remarks. But in a way, you kind of the science speaks for itself. The evidence that we have in front of us speak for ourselves. And at the end of the day, we're not going to be silenced by people's intimidations and threats, because that's all it is.
Have you been to Gaza, Bilal?
So I've been to the West Bank. I actually went there last year on a medical mission. But as we know, with Gaza, it's the access is extremely difficult.
Last question. Some while ago, not too long ago, you published another piece in the Lancet entitled "Will There Be a Future for Newborns in Gaza?" So, can you answer that question for me? Will there be a future for newborns in Gaza?
So there'll be a piece coming out in tomorrow titled "Is Gaza Still a Place for Newborn Life?" as a follow-up to that piece tomorrow in The Lancet. So the answer will somewhat be there, but I guess in short, I mean, we know there was an estimate that was published earlier this year already looking at how life expectancy has dropped by so many decades in Gaza, and they had stratified it by the different genders. But with It's hard to say. I mean, Israel has deliberately killed, I mean, pregnant women. I mean, we've seen some of those images, some of those videos of, I mean, babies being brought out. I mean, from dead. I mean, their mothers have been killed, and those babies are being are like, I mean, there's like emergency C-sections happening to try to save a baby, after the mother has been killed. I mean, there's been cases of mothers who've been crushed, and there have been attempts to save the baby. Or sometimes, I mean, you even see videos of Israeli soldiers talk boasting about killing pregnant women. So, I mean, there's that. And then there's also the fact that pregnant women are right now focused on trying to get, like everyone else in Gaza, focused on trying to get food. And they're going to these GHF, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid distribution sites, where they're being shot at by the Israeli military. I mean, there's been investigate reports now, I think, by MSF, by Human Rights Watch, and I think now by The Guardian, at least just in the last 2, 3 weeks, looking at this issue. So pregnant women are just one of the consequences of that. And then we also know the numbers, which this piece that's coming out tomorrow will talk about, is the birth rate has also declined, right, from 2022. If you just compare it to 2022, I forgot the exact number, so I don't want to say it, but it's declined by a substantial percentage.
And that's one of the definitions of genocide.
Yeah, the prevention of births. And we talk about that in the piece, the prevention of births. And I mean, it's clearly a deliberate prevention of births in Gaza, and creating the conditions to prevent births.
I mean, the conditions that pregnant women face in Gaza today, I have no idea how many pregnant women there are in Gaza today. I'm sure it's like tens of thousands. And I can't begin to fathom what it would be like for a pregnant woman, a woman to go through her pregnancy and reach late term, and I can't wrap my head around it.
Yeah, I mean, we know baby formula has been denied, right? And I know a neonatologist that was just denied entry to Gaza as well. So, I mean, all of this is very prevalent. And then another issue is, if I can just conclude on this, is that, I mean, a lot of people don't have an incentive to continue attempting to have children. And obviously there's a lot of people who feel oppositely, who feel actually that because of the genocide we're absolutely going to, like, it's like they, some of them feel like it's our duty to continue our lives as they would have been, and to kind of stay in the face of adversity. But there's a lot of people who, in many ways, rightfully say, like, what is left for a newborn in Gaza? What is life going to be like for them? And so I've talked to a number of people who say that they do not want to have children in Gaza, or that they know people who don't want to have children in Gaza, and that if they one day leave Gaza, maybe they'll have children, or if they plan to stay there, they may or may not. I mean, just depending on the circumstance. And so we have to take in that kind of human factor in decision making, which is also obviously driving the behavior and birth rates that we're seeing.
And those babies who are born in Gaza, who have just been born and are under, I mean, the impacts, the developmental impacts will be, will span their entire lives, and the lives of their children. If they have children, there will be transgenerational impacts.
And low birth weights, we already have seen that being recorded and stuff. And I'm talking to a team right now at one of the hospitals that is recording, is trying to record at least cases of pregnant women, as well as some neonatal data. And I mean, I just had a text just a few hours before, I mean, we got, I mean, just a few minutes actually before we got on this call. I mean, we were just talking about, like, okay, well, the Israelis may attack this hospital. What are we going to do? How are we going to preserve the data? Because, and in many ways, I mean, we were discussing this so candidly just like 2 hours ago, that we know that this data, and even what we, for example, published right now in this comment, I mean, this is not going to unfortunately change Israel's conduct in the Gaza Strip. And unfortunately, we don't really believe that it's going to stop people's behavior in supplying and arming Israel to the teeth to conduct genocide. But in many ways, it's to be a reflection for maybe somewhere 100 years from now, someone's going to be listening to this interview or reading that paper and being able to at least learn about it. Maybe someone's going to be doing a PhD thesis on multi-drug resistant bacteria or on maternal and neonatal deaths in Gaza, and we'll have that data for them to look at. So unfortunately, this is the reality that Palestinians know and face and very acutely are aware of.
I wanted to ask you a really, truly last question. What makes you that horrible last question? What makes you hopeful? Is there anything in the situation when you're kind of pondering this that makes you think, things are going to turn out okay? It's just going to be a long time.
I mean, I guess there's two ways to answer this question, and I'll give you both. I mean, one is I mean, we do see people's perspectives have changed somewhat. We see more and more media talking about the genocide. We see more and more organizations talking about it. There's that. Obviously, at the same time, at least in the context of the US, the censorship is also insane, and a lot of people are self-policing. So it's kind of a tit for tat in that sense, almost a tug of war of, like, it's getting better, but it's also getting worse. And then the genocide is escalating, but at the same time, more people are speaking out. We have these freedom flotillas that are going. So it's, I mean, it gives me hope that eventually every atrocity has to end. And so it's just the knowledge of history that eventually it will end. But I don't know if that's going to end anytime soon. And even if the genocide in its acute phase stops right now, the wider Israeli apartheid system, the wider Israeli occupation, which is the root determinant of all of this, the settler colonialism, I mean, that system has to end. And I don't know when it's going to end, but I'm hopeful. And then I'm hopeful only insofar as that it has to end sometime. Maybe I'm not going to be alive by then, but it will end eventually. And then I guess the other part of this answer is from a faith-based perspective. I think all evil has to come to an end, and I think that's something I really believe from a religious perspective. So, yeah.
Bilal Irfan, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
Bilal Irfan is a bioethicist at Harvard Medical School and a researcher at the medical school's Brigham and Women's Hospital, specializing in conflict health. Irfan has been collaborating with Palestinian medical students and physicians in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza in the documentation of Israeli medicide. Irfan and his colleagues have just published several pieces about the health situation in Gaza in the British medical journal The Lancet. We'll link to those papers at greenplanetmonitor.net. that's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Is Bird Note. In the desert southwest, summer temperatures sizzle, rising well over 100 degrees. And in some parts of the desert, there is not a drop of water for miles. Yet some birds thrive in this scorching landscape. Here, a black-throated sparrow sings from the thorn scrub. Now, a cactus wren announces itself atop a barrel cactus. And neither will be flying miles every day to the nearest source of water. So how do they survive? Birds, like all animals, perish without water. Desert birds, however, make the most of very little. They tuck into the shade in the heat of the day, so they won't lose water in panting. They have extremely efficient kidneys, so they excrete almost no liquid. And they obtain moisture from foods, like nectar and fruit, as well as insects and other prey. Even when eating primarily seeds, black-throated sparrows are able to extract enough water from this dry food that they may never need to take a drink. Still, when that next late summer thunderstorm arrives, you have to think those temporary puddles are going to look mighty refreshing. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians. The music library. Acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent. Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
Atención.
Yucastéreo. Domingos, 6 a 8 p.m. 90.1 CJSF Radio.
CJSF
90.1
Chango.
90.1 FM. Yucastéreo.
Atención.